as we think about eagles and such like. Maybe we should read these verses again. Verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel? My way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Of course, that little last section reminds us of the fact that we are all weak, aren't we? We grow tired and we grow weary. We stumble and we fall. And we tend not to soar on wings like eagles. We tend to start running spiritually. And as time goes by, we grow weary quickly. We tend to start the walk of faith and faint at the prospects and the challenges that meet us in the walk of faith. So how can we change this? I mean, how can we get to the point where we are at verse 31, that we actually are soaring like eagles, running, walking in faith? How can we become like this? What is the answer? Well, the answer is certainly not that we become supermen or superwoman trying to do and to be in our own strength. That's not God's answer at all. God wants us to believe what we're supposed to believe and to set our hearts on things above. We're to believe what we're to believe and set our hearts on things above. And as we do this, as we long for God and believe in God and receive from God, then he will give us his power and lift us up and renew us and empower us, and we will soar like eagles. We will be able to run and walk in the way of faith. Set our hearts on things above. And of course, that immediately remind me of the passage in Colossians chapter 3 and these verses. Since then, you've been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. So what are these things above that we're supposed to set our hearts and minds? What are they? Well, they're not physical things of heaven. I mean, we're not to imagine, for instance, the literal throne of Jesus. Rather, we're talking here about the sovereign rule and reign over the universe of Jesus. His presence, I mean, his power, his personality, his rule, his character, his love. And we are to, as we thought this morning, imitate these things. And it requires continuous effort. You'll notice the word set. Set your hearts on things above. Set your minds on things above. That's a present imperative, which means a continuous, ongoing effort. This is to be our desire. This is to be our determination. We are to persistently seek and keep on setting. Set your minds, set your hearts. Keep doing it day after day, day after day, day after day. I mean, how many people seek an Olympic gold medal? You know, we're in the countdown to the big event, aren't we? Thousands and thousands of athletes going there wanting to get the gold medal. How many people will be seeking a Champions League final medal even this week? The battle begins. Who's going to get to the final? Who's going to win the final? Some people even seek to climb the likes of Mount Everest. There's an endless list of the things that people seek. Great or not so great as these things are, nothing can hold a candle to the things above. And the Christian is to seek the things above. And this heavenly seeking is to be done through prayer and study as we ask and as we seek and as we knock for the things above. And this heavenly seeking ought to permeate our conversations, our friendships, our studies, our work, even our play. But there's a problem here. There's a major competition going on. Because as we are called to seek and to set our hearts on things above, or set our minds on things above, there is a competition. You notice how that ends there. Not on earthly things. Not on earthly things. Things of this world. Things that we need to exist, but These things in themselves can become idols. I mean, it's absurd to suggest that it's wrong to seek excellence or achievement in our jobs, or for instance, in our studies. It's absurd, silly. Taken to that extreme, it means that no Christian would ever be good at anything. Of course, we should do our best in our workplace. We should do our best in our studies. We should do our best on the sports field if that's where we're found. But the difference for the Christian is that no longer are we to see these things as if they are the only thing that matters. So our job is to be important to us, but not the idol in our lives. The home that we have sought to design and create is to be special to us. Of course it is, but that should not be the idol that takes over everything. Our children, we're to love them and nurture them, but they should not become our idols. You see, our mindset is to be dominated, not on the things of the earth, but by things above. I want you to imagine if on the day you die, someone were to do a divine post-mortem on your mind. What would the results be? You know what a post-mortem is on the body to discover the cause of death. Imagine someone were to perform a divine post-mortem on your mind, and the results of it would reveal your highest priorities. What would it be? If someone tonight were to come and read your mind, what's number 1, 2, 3, 10, 12? What are your priorities? The precise command of these verses from Colossians are to set our minds on things above and keep it that way. Keep it that way. And our prayer should be, Lord, set my mind on things above. But let's be honest. For most of the people, in most times, in most places, this is not what we do. We don't think on things above. We don't set our minds on things above. And it's certainly true in the time of Isaiah chapter 40. But what about you? As we look at these people and see where they went wrong and how they eventually turned it around, we've got to ask the question, what about me? Where am I? First of all, let's think of despondency. We see that in the first verse there of our passage tonight, verse 27. There's angry words here. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? The people were despondent, angry, filled with doubts, burdened with questions which have no answers. Again, does that not sound familiar? We live in a society that is plagued with a lack of sleep, low energy, discouragement, rampant depression, a loss of joy. And the signs are everywhere we look. Addictive behaviors that seek to satisfy some empty spot in the soul. Angry people with angry attitudes. Hospitals and clinics that are filled with people who are physically fine but spiritually sick, overwhelmed, overburdened, and often isolated. Welcome to the human race. Welcome to the fallen human race. Somebody said, you know, the expression human race is very apt. It is a race, like a marathon, isn't it? It just goes on and on. And so we hear the words of verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? These are words that just speak of a loss of confidence, a loss of courage, a loss of hope. Devastating and destructive cries come from the hearts of these people. In fact, the words of Psalm 137 come to mind when we think about this despondency. Boney M. might be the name of a group that says something to people of a certain age. And if you're young, it means absolutely nothing. But they made some of the verses of Psalm 137 particularly famous, even though a lot of people didn't realize that the words were from the Bible. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept
when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. But how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? And that depicts the demoralized condition in which these people were in. The Jewish exile seemed to have been floating somewhere between struggling faith and cynical defiance. Struggling faith, cynical defiance. Like many, if truth be told today. Struggle, 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 cynicism. So what does God do? Well, he acts in glorious grace. He tells them who he is, and we thought that last week, back at verse 12 through to 26. I cannot be measured, I cannot be compared, I cannot be rivaled. That's what that's all about. Then he tells them who they are. And you'll notice how he describes them there in verse 27. O Jacob, O Israel. Now, sometimes it's in the detail that the details in the small things or the important are actually in the seemingly unimportant words. Remember the significance of Jacob. I mean, what did Jacob do on one occasion? When in doubt, do you remember that night he wrestled with God? Do you remember that? And who did Jacob become? Israel. You see, Jacob was desperate for answers, desperate for blessings, so desperate he wrestled with God. He wrestled with God. And here's the point, you see. God always blesses those who long for him. God always blesses those who long for his blessing, who are desperate enough to wrestle, who are desperate enough to struggle with him. And when we struggle, and when we're despondent, when we feel isolated, when we feel forgotten by God, we've got to do what Jacob did. Grab God. Grab God. And hold him tight. And wrestle with him. And struggle with him. And if we do, we're guaranteed to come out as conquerors, not victims. And really what God is saying there as he describes these people as Jacob and Israel, he's saying, you are my people and I will never forsake you. I will never forsake you. Just you hang in there. Come to me. Bring your struggles with you to me. Wrestle with me. Wrestle. And I will bring you through. I wonder tonight, are you despondent? There's two things you need to know. Who God is and who you are. And somewhere in between those two things will be the thing that may will release you and urge you forward. And he invites you to be like Jacob. Come on, bring your problems to me. Bring those issues to me. Those hurts, the anger, the pain. Wrestle with me. And I will reward you. So the problem was despondency. The answer is twofold. In verse 28 and 29, we're going to see they needed some theology. We're going to look at that just in a few moments too. And we get that with the pointed reiteration of the doctrine of God. Do you not know? And we hear that again and again through these verses. Do you not know? Have you not heard? But after the doctrine, we've got the experience. Resting, trusting, waiting, hoping. And together, and in this order, is the biblical way of renewal. So let's go from despondency to the doctrine that we see, or the theology in verse 28 and 29. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. Some people think that because God is so far removed from us, that he's like transcendent, that he's too great to care. He's too great to be interested in you. Well, that's wrong. It's not that he's too great to care, he's too great to feel. It's not that he's too great to care, he's too great to feel. And everything that really matters in life relies on who God is. Not on who you are, not on who is around you, or what you've got as far as natural capabilities or resources, but who he is. And look at these two verses, and it's full of good theology about God. And if we're going to get beyond despondency, if we're going to be like eagles rather than turkeys, then this is what we've got to understand. First of all, he's everlasting. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God. Do you know our problem as human beings? We are constantly controlled by what we call a time slot called now. We're constantly under the power and influence of time. You know, even you always see me tick that off, don't you? And you wonder, why do I tick it off? Because it doesn't seem, you don't seem to ever look at it, you know, to know when to stop. But that's it, you know, the preacher controlled by time. Well, except it was named Lucas, of course. Yeah. Time. We live in this time slot called now. We're always living in the shadow of time. And there's so little time, little of it, you know. Weeks, months, years pass by. They flash by. I'm looking forward to Wednesday. Payday. Another payday. The fourth of this year. It just goes so fast. And those of you who are older, can I look at anybody? It just goes so fast, doesn't it? Time. And we worry about the past, and we worry about the present, and we worry about the future. We have our timetables, don't we? We have our deadlines. But you know what? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is an everlasting God. He's not confined to time at all. He lives outside of time, outside the influence of time. 1,000 years are like a day as far as he's concerned. A day is like 1,000 years. So from the time that Jesus was here, 2,000 years, to God, that's like 2 days. He's always 1,000 or 1,000,000 steps ahead of us. He knows the end from the beginning. So put theology into practice. If this is the case, that God is an everlasting God, don't panic. Who was it in Dad's army said, don't panic, Corporal Jones or Captain or somebody? Don't panic. Don't panic as he panicked. And that's what we say. Oh, I'm not panicking. I'm not panicking. We're panicking. We're panicking. Don't panic. God is an everlasting God. And one of the commentators I read this week put it like this, and I could have pretended it was mine, but that wouldn't be right with it. This is what he said. God is working his purpose out in his own way, at his own pace, without our hurried, nervous desperation. That's what it is. He's everlasting. He's creator. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the creator of the ends of the earth. What does he mean here? Well, every last square millimeter of space or matter is made by him and for him. We thought about that last week. The universe is so big that they don't know how big it is. The universe is so big that they reckon it's still being created, even now. And every last millimeter is made by him and for him. No matter if you go north or south or east or west, he made it all. And the point is, for these people, of course, was that whether they be exiled in Babylon or back in Jerusalem, God is always near me. Oh, I want to sing the hymn. God is always near me, hearing what I say, knowing all my thoughts and deeds, all my work and play. At the graveside, in the examination hall, in Belfast or Rich Hill, during chemo or waiting for results. We live in his grace and power at all times and everywhere, because this is our God. He is the creator God. He made every last bit of space. He's the untiring God. That's the next thing. Do you not know? Have you not heard? He will not grow tired or weary. Again, here's another human problem. We're controlled by time. We also have this idea that God is weary and weak just like us. We suffer from weariness. We suffer from weakness, therefore God must be the same. That's very human and it's very wrong. And this is where we need theology so that we understand who God is. We get tired, we want to quit, so we figure God gets tired and wants to quit, and we figure wrong. You know the statistics. Most of us spend a third of our lives in bed just to get enough energy to deal with the other two-thirds. But he has an inexhaustible source of energy and power. An inexhaustible source of energy and power. Psalm 121. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. Again, the same commentator put it like this. He never grows tired or weary, but is forever fresh, always alert, always able. Isn't that good to know? Do you wake up on a Monday morning feeling tired? Do you wake up every morning feeling tired? Forever fresh, always alert, and always able. This is our God. He's wise. Do you not know? Have you not heard? His understanding no one can fathom. How can we understand the ununderstandable? Is there such a word as ununderstandable? But you know what I mean? How can we understand the ununderstandable? There are depths of his wisdom that we can't access. We can't even begin to touch it. But he knows exactly what he's doing. We don't figure out his ways by our brains. We don't figure out his ways by our brains. We submit to him by our faith. That's what he calls. And some people are so clever and so arrogant. They say, I want to understand God. I want to understand how he does things. I want to dictate the terms. No, you don't. You are like a little insect compared to him. There's no way you can understand him. His understanding no one can fathom. So God is always right now. God is always right here. God is always at work. God is always wise. Get this theology into your heads. Get this theology into your hearts. It will radically change the way you think. And verse 29, look what he does, this great God. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Who are the weak? Who are the weary? Well, they are the complainers of verse 27. Their faith is faint. Their spirituality is weak. Their courage is dying. They feel like quitting. And so he tells them, I'll give you strength and power. And that leads us very naturally into the last point, the experience. Once we have our theology, our understanding, our doctrine of God worked out, then we can experience him in a pure way. The problem with many people today is that they want to experience God without understanding who he is, and that's dangerous. Experience, verse 30 and 31. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength and will soar in wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Some who are young, and once upon a time I was like that, we think we're invincible. We think we can do it all. We're cocky and sure of ourselves. I'm in my prime. I'm strong. Leave me alone. I can go solo. That's what a lot of people think when they're young. And God says to them in verse 30, you're no match. You are simply no match to the demands of life. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But with him and with his power, we can do what is seemingly impossible. That's the reference to the flying like eagles and running and not grow weary and walking and not being faint. With him and his power, experienced after we understand who he is, we can do what seems impossible. The weak will soar like eagles and run without tiring and walk without quitting. Now, I've never been able to fly, but I've tried running on occasions. And after, an eighth of a mile, I give up, generally speaking. I even try walking. I can get a wee bit further. I might even be able to, I could do 5 miles, probably, but to the test. But then I want to quit. But spiritually speaking, we can do the impossible with him. Now, it's not a matter of willpower, it's a matter of God power. It's spirit power we're talking about. And the secret is there in verse 31. But those who hope, that's the secret. Other translations have wait. And it basically means the same thing. It means to live in the set our hearts on things above mindset. It's going back to how we began. It's steady, rugged progress, eyes set on the goal while we trudge through this fallen world. Renewing strength and mind and will in line with Scripture. Allowing God to set the pace and to set the direction. You know, the temptation is that we try and control things rather than live under his terms. And it can be, very often, you know, a little bit of him and a little bit of the world. We thought about that last week, a wee bit of this and that. And we make up our own idea of God and our own idea of spirituality. But basically, it all boils down to setting our hearts on things below. And that's the problem for many of us. The reason why we struggle is that we've set our hearts on things below rather than set our hearts on things above. And if we choose to set our hearts on things below, then we're on our own. And God will leave us on our own. We often hope in wrong people and wrong places. The quick fix, the easy answer, the suitable for me approach, the mix and match spirituality. For instance, even among some young people, you will hear these things. You know, I'll do the church bit. I'll do the Bible reading bit. I'll do the small group bit. But not the praying. Not the spiritual disciplines. Not the sexual purity. Not the tithing. You see, what we need is a cleaner view of God and a clearer view of God and a keener passion for his glory. So how can I experience what Isaiah talks about here? Like soaring like an eagle spiritually, running without tiring spiritually, walking without quitting spiritually. How can I do this? Because this is what I want to know. I want to soar. I want to run. I want to walk. Well, the answer is transferring the loyalty of our hearts from the things of the world to him. That's the answer. Transferring the loyalty of our hearts from the things of the world to him. And here's the big question. Has Jesus got your heart? Has Jesus got your heart? He may have your faith. That's easy. But has he got your heart? What did we say this morning? The easy thing for God is to get us fit for heaven, isn't it? That's done in an instant called salvation. The hard bit is to get us to live here now. And so the Bible tells us to imitate God. It's easy for Jesus to have my faith. But does he have my heart? And therein lies the difference between soaring like an eagle or flopping around like a turkey. Does Jesus have my heart? If I have my faith in God and yet keep my heart in the world and have all my little idols that I worship and bow down to and pursue and please, then God will not give me his power, and I will soar like a frozen turkey. I will run and be ever weary. I will walk and constantly faint. And some Christians live defeated lives because God allows them to. I say that again because it's crucial. Some Christians live defeated lives because God allows them to. He simply will not support our worldliness. He will not support our carnality. But to those who seek first the kingdom of God, to those who set their hearts on things above, to those who fight the good fight, who finish the race, who keep the faith, he says, you can soar like eagles. You can run and never get weary. You can walk and never faint. You know, it's not rocket science, but it is heart surgery. So does Jesus have your heart? What are the idols that you have in your heart today that block the blessing? What are the idols you have today that are stop you soaring? You know you're flapping around for all it takes. You want to soar, but you're not. Why? What idols are there that are keeping you from that? What causes the constant spiritual weariness? You want to run, but you get 10 yards. You get a mile, and then you just want to drop. What causes you to quit? See, Jesus must have your heart. He must have your heart. If he doesn't have your heart, you're done. You're on your own. And you can try to be as religious as you might possibly be, but you will fail. So tonight, do we want to soar like eagles? Or are we just going to flop about like a turkey? It's a matter of the heart. Let's pray.